Hi, Patrick here. It's a new podcast and a new world in Egypt and maybe beyond. We have lots of names for strong leaders. Emperor, Tsar, Generalissimo, the Iron Lady. How about Pharaoh? Some Egyptians believe they've just overthrown the last Pharaoh. Also, fears over the future of Cantonese and veteran British band The Gang of Four, spot that cultural reference, are obsessed by farm phrases, as in, he paid for the farm.
There's also that phrase which they use in the army when someone gets killed, is he bought the farm. And this entertaining idea that you only really get to pay for the farm when you bought the farm.
And on that farm he had a revolutionary E-I-E-I-O. This podcast, The World in Words, and The World Radio Program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. This podcast is at theworld.org/language. You can find my blog post also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. The pod is on Facebook. It has its own page, The World in Words. Also, I tweet a bunch of language stuff. My Twitter handle is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. Today, we start with some names of leaders, and one name in particular, the last pharaoh, Hosni Mubarak, former leader of Egypt. Then, as the year of the rabbit gets underway, we consider the future prospects of Cantonese, which was once very much the international dialect of Chinese. And then a band with a name inspired by recent Chinese history, the Gang of Four. So first, Hosni Mubarak. He finally called it a day, 30 years after becoming Egypt's president. I'm going to do a couple of little things on Mubarak. First, here's an excerpt from a report filed by The Big Show's Ben Gilbert from the day Mubarak stepped down. As I speak, that was 4 days ago. Ben recorded this just an hour or two before the official announcement on a street lined with anti-Mubarak protesters outside the government-run TV headquarters. You'll hear a female voice at one point. That is Ben's translator. For now, I'm going to call her a translator. But maybe next time, I'll call her an interpreter. More on that word later. Here goes.
A Muslim imam led Friday prayers in front of state TV for thousands of the protesters. Barbed wire separated them from the building. Tanks, armored vehicles, and dozens of soldiers ringed the structure. But the soldiers prayed on the other side of the barbed wire, listening to the imam's angry words for the president.
He's likening him to the pharaohs now, who wreaked havoc in their society and killed their sons. The pharaoh of this nation is repeating the same mistakes.
Now, it's not just one cleric who's been comparing Mubarak to a pharaoh. Many commentators, both inside and outside Egypt, have done just the same thing. Some have called him the country's last pharaoh. That's kind of a nice soundbite. Sounds pretty snappy, along the lines of maybe calling Vladimir Putin Russia's last czar. But that doesn't really tell the whole story. But you know what? The Big Show's Alex Galifant does. Well, a little bit anyway. Here's his report.
Egyptians play fast and loose with their famous heritage. After all, the national soccer team is nicknamed the Pharaohs. But when it comes to politics, says Joshua Stacker at Kent State University, calling somebody a pharaoh is an insult.
If we go back 4,000 years, pharaohs were kings that ruled for life and built grand monuments to themselves and ruled arbitrarily and divided and rule. So it's not a good term.
And Stacker disputes the idea that Mubarak was the last pharaoh.
I mean, there's plenty of pharaohs in the palace ready to take over. It's not a term of endearment.
Maybe not right now. But the pyramids of the pharaohs cast long shadows in Cairo, where Tarek Osman lives. He's the author of Egypt on the Brink.
The pharaoh also in the Egyptian psyche is the semi-god who ensured the provision of water to the Egyptian peasants, and that is an extremely positive role in the deep Egyptian psyche.
But over the past 50 or 60 years, Osman says the notion of the pharaoh has morphed into a more generic father of the nation idea, a change encouraged by Hosni Mubarak and his predecessors, Presidents Nasser and Sadat. Nasser portrayed himself as the inspiring leader of a national regeneration.
It was more of a grandeur of a historical project. Sadat adopted a completely different modus operandi. Sadat was the onda, as we say in Egypt, the man who attends the weddings and the funerals, and his choice of words were very colloquial, unlike Nasser, who mastered the classic Arabic language. So Sadat enacted a very different patriarch role.
And then came Mubarak. And unlike the other two, he came from a military background. For him, building a strongman narrative fit best.
The firm, solid protector. Protect the land, protect the people, protect the national security.
Sounds familiar, especially to Russians. They have their own deep-rooted ideal of leadership, the Tsar.
The image of the Tsar is alive and well in Russia today.
Marshall Poe is a historian at the University of Iowa.
Russians strongly believe that Russia is the kind of country that needs what they call a strong hand. It is a legacy of Tsarism. It is also a legacy of Soviet rule. And the basic premise here is that Russia is a very unruly place, that Russians themselves are unruly, and therefore they need somebody powerful in the center to make things run right.
Stalin was a Tsar of sorts. Now Putin is. History suggests that Russians don't trust themselves to run things. A form of democracy came to Russia in the 90s, and yet the figure of the Tsar persists. It speaks to a deep-seated mistrust of democracy that's not really that unusual around the world.
It's pretty rare to walk up to somebody and go, do you think if we put power in the hands of, like, everyone, that things would be okay? They would look at you like you were from Mars. The idea that, you know, inside every Egyptian or North Korean or something, there's like an American trying to get out and go to the polling booth is false.
After President Mubarak promised not to stand for re-election, Tarek Osman listened to Egyptians calling in to live radio programs. He says many repeated the same thing.
So he is our father. He is our father. If you just make a survey of how many times the word father was said, I think it was by far more than any other word.
Osman says the contemporary mixture of pharaoh and father figure embodied by Hosni Mubarak won't go, but he does expect it to fade. More and more Egyptians are educated and connected. And for them, the pharaoh belongs only in the museum. For the World, I'm Alex Galifant.
And before we leave Mubarak to the historians, I just want to note a couple more interesting little linguistic things. One is a brand new word, or it may become so, Mubaraktik. And it's thought to be the invention of a South Korean tweeter. Who knows? It means, or it has come to mean, can't take a hint, or tightly clings to the chair. Not sure if that'll catch on now that Mubarak now has taken the hint. Anyway, it's a nice one. There was also a wildly popular hashtag on Twitter in the hours after Mubarak gave his last speech, just the day before he stepped down. Now, that was the speech when everyone from the White House on down thought that he was actually going to resign there and then, and he didn't. That hashtag was Reasons Mubarak is Late. All one word, you know, the way those hashtags are. It was very funny. There was a ton of really amusing things being written there at great speed. Is someone compiling hashtags, you know, for a book or something or a blog? I'm sure they are. And, well, if not, they need to be. Maybe someone can send me a link to a blog or something. Last thing on Egypt, there were a bunch of stories over the past couple of weeks about signs that protesters were carrying in Cairo. And among them were some signs in Chinese. I'll post links at patrickcox.wordpress.com and theworld.org/language. There's a great blog post been written about those. Now, onto an email that was written to the big show, but I'm going to deal with it here because it's about language. And if you're a listener to NPR's All Things Considered, you might have heard a similar sentiment expressed by the same emailer. They read out her email. Her name is Judy Jenner, and here's what she wrote to us. Loved your segment on Egypt a few minutes ago. I'm a huge fan of the world. However, I must correct you as you incorrectly used the term translator. No one can speak through a translator, only through an interpreter. Translators work with the written word, while interpreters work with the spoken word. I am both, meaning the emailer, Judy Jenner, is both. And the distinction is quite important to educate the general public about the importance of language services. Judy, thank you. Now, I'm no wordsmith. Heck, I'm a journalist. I mean, I'm paid to make mistakes on a daily basis. But having rigorously investigated this claim on Google, I got to say that Judy is absolutely right. Translators, written, interpreters, spoken. And yet, there's always an and yet, isn't there? Well, aside from making mistakes, we in the news media are most certainly paid to express things as clearly as possible. And that's where I have a slight problem with the term interpreter. My problem is that the word interpret, the verb, which aside from meaning to translate orally, it also means to explain the meaning of something or to understand something to mean something, which can be several steps beyond translation. And if a listener were to take that shade of meaning from the word interpreter, it could be misleading. So that's my caveat. In the meantime, maybe I'll get just a little used to using the word interpreter. Okay, Cantonese now. Happy Year of the Rabbit, everyone. I can say that in Mandarin, Tu Nian Kuai Le. But I can't say it in Cantonese because, like the vast majority of people learning Chinese, I am, of course, learning Mandarin. Mandarin is displacing Cantonese and other dialects in places where you'd have previously expected to have found those dialects, in Chinatowns all over the world. And the trend toward one single dialect, well, that does not sit well with some expat Chinese, especially native Cantonese speakers. Here's a story from Nina Porzuki in New York.
Every Thursday night, you can find Kim Mui at a noisy cafe in the heart of Manhattan's Chinatown.
So everybody, this is the conversational class. Some of you
Mui teaches Cantonese lessons to adults, and she's animated, jumping out of her seat as her students strain to hear her over all the sounds in the cafe. Mui doesn't make any money teaching Cantonese. Her students pay no tuition, just donations. There are no fancy flashcards, just a book she's put together over nearly a decade of teaching.
I learned that my ancestors, who are Cantonese, they came to America during the Gold Rush, and they came to build the United States Transcontinental Railroad, and I know they struggled a lot. They helped to build this country, and a lot of people don't know about it. So I want to pay tribute to my ancestors by teaching other people Cantonese, because I know a lot of people want to learn it. That's why I'm doing it.
A decade ago, the majority of Chinese Americans were of Cantonese origin, and Cantonese was the Chinese dialect spoken in Chinatown. Not so anymore. New immigrants from different regions of China have brought different dialects like Fuzhou and Hakka. Chinese shares a common writing system, but when spoken, each dialect is mutually unintelligible. And this is way more than just tomato-tomato, says Julie Tay, director of the Asian Cultural Exchange, a learning center in New York's Chinatown.
So you have no structural differences in the expression, I love you, for example. In Mandarin, it's 我爱你. And in Cantonese, it's 我爱你.
But it looks exactly the same.
Of course, in written form, it would be the same.
So no matter which Chinese dialect any two people speak, they can share the same newspaper, they can
read the same article and laugh, you know, about the same things. But they may not be able to speak to one another.
Tay says that more and more speakers of Cantonese and other dialects are turning towards the northern dialect of Mandarin. Mandarin is the default, the broker dialect between dialects. The growing influence of Mandarin in New York mirrors, to a certain extent, what's happening more forcefully in China. Every city, every town even in China, speaks some dialect variety.
Now so many people are moving around that they must turn to Mandarin.
This is lexicographer David Prager Branner. He says the Chinese government is stepping up its enforcement of Mandarin as the lingua franca of the country. Children speak Mandarin in school, Mandarin is used for government business and commerce, and as Mandarin becomes ever more necessary to communicate.
There are a lot of people who simply don't know the language of their grandparents. Now, in America, that's not unusual. If your parents come from, you seem to have a Polish surname, right? Do you know any Polish?
One word.
All right. It doesn't bother us so much. China is a huge country. You know, it's got one government, okay, but culturally it's like Europe. It's all these different local societies that could easily be different countries. And local language is a big part of what makes you feel that you are who you are.
This was especially apparent this summer in the Cantonese-speaking province of Guangdong. A politician proposed that regional TV news be broadcast in Mandarin instead of Cantonese. His comments sparked demonstrations. Protesters held up signs that read, "If you can't understand what we're saying, then go back to where you came from." Julie Tay says Beijing was quick to recant the politician's proposal.
whoever this official was saying that, oh, of course, you know, we didn't mean to eliminate Cantonese. Cantonese culture will continue to be strong and to flourish and everything, you know, those typical party lines. But the guy was saying it all in Mandarin.
In New York City, no one is enforcing Mandarin over Cantonese. And, says Tay, while Mandarin is increasingly used for the mundane, day-to-day interactions between neighbors,
most people see Mandarin as being really pale and humorless. You know, and it's not a language you can make love in or fight with, you know? Whereas Cantonese is something else.
Of course, she would think that. Cantonese is her native tongue. And it's still the native tongue for more than 70 million people in China and around the world.
We're going to go around.
Back at the Chinatown Cafe, Cantonese teacher Kim Mui shrugs off the notion that her first language could be replaced by Mandarin. It won't if she has anything to do with it. But as Mandarin continues to gain influence, it will take many people, as dedicated as she is, to ensure that their kids can speak more than one word in Cantonese. For the world, I'm Nina Porzuki.
As well as teaching Cantonese, Kim Mui also speaks and teaches a Cantonese sub-dialect. Gets a bit complicated here. That dialect is called Toisanhua. You might have heard her say that at the top of the piece. Now, Toisanhua is sometimes known in the English-speaking world as Taishanese. It's kind of the original generic Chinatown dialect. Well, if you want to hear more about Toisanhua and Cantonese and a great Toisanhua tongue twister, check out The World in Words number 74. That's my conversation with poet and writer Marilyn Chin. I'll post the link. Now, while Chinese immigrants were spreading Cantonese and other dialects around the world a few generations ago, back home, things were pretty grim. Like in the late 60s and early 70s, at the height of China's Cultural Revolution, that was the movement to purge the country of capitalist thought, which meant, among other things, that anyone deemed bourgeois or religious was denounced, sent into internal exile, in some cases killed. The most notorious enforcers of this policy were a group of senior members of the Communist Party known as the Gang of Four. One of them was Mao Zedong's last wife. Now, the Gang of Four were themselves eventually denounced and blamed for the excesses of the Cultural Revolution. So why did a British rock band that formed just a few years after the Gang of Four were stripped of power, why did they call themselves the Gang of Four? Well, the answer may have something to do with the state of Britain at the time. The 1970s were grim. There were strikes, electricity cuts, a three-day week. And then in 1979, Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. She set about breaking Britain's powerful unions. Thatcher's longest, most controversial confrontation was with the National Union of Mine Workers, whose heartland was close to where the band, the Gang of Four, lived in Leeds, in northern England. Now, you're going to hear a reference in the segment that follows to a place called Orgreave. That was the scene of a pitched battle between thousands of striking miners and thousands of police officers. It was so intense that it really shocked the British public. There was this sense that the country was sliding into some form of civil war almost. Well, the Gang of Four were putting out records through all of that. And they're back now with a new CD and with some very interesting takes on a couple of expressions that include the word farm. The BBC's Tom Bateman has been to meet them.
Entertainment was your first album out in 1979. What's your memory of the mood of the age?
Very, very, very polarised. I mean, it was a time unlike certainly any that we can remember. In no sense are we interested in banging the drum for socialism.
I mean, you were named after part of the Chinese Communist Party.
They were cultural revolutionaries, and that's what we considered ourselves to be.
My name's John King and I'm the singer in the Gang of Four.
I'm Andy Gill and I'm the guitarist in Gang of Four. The extreme polarisation which in Leeds, we felt like we were at the coalface of that, and there was a kind of almost tangible violent atmosphere in the place.
You clearly saw an agenda which was set out to change the way the nation was. So we saw armed medieval-style battles between the police and the miners at the Battle of Orgreave, for example, which was an extraordinary sight.
What is the role, though, of music in politics now? Because, I mean, you were really leading this kind of post-punk movement, and as you've already said, you know, it felt like a very, very polarised time, and the music really sort of captured that in terms of where you were coming from. And is that sort of thing possible now?
This album is a sort of sister piece, I think, in some respects, to entertainment. The times are very different, that we have potentially a benevolent society which will give us all a happy and comfortable youth, middle age and dotage is probably an illusion. One of the songs we've written is a song called You'll Never Pay for the Farm. You'll never pay for the farm. Paying for the farm is one of those things you need to do when you need to have a certain amount of income to just sort of keep your head above water. There's also that phrase which they use in the army when someone gets killed, is he bought the farm. And this entertaining idea that you only really get to pay for the farm when you bought the farm. And this endless drudgery of paying for other people's errors, paying for other people's crimes, which we've all been burdened with, is an extraordinary thing that we're going through.
That song is probably, we were kind of halfway through writing it when this kind of earthquake of financial collapse and credit crunch and all the rest of it suddenly came upon the world. And we were sort of halfway through the song and said, blimey, it's almost as if we were writing about what's going on.
We're living through the most amazing, dramatic, interesting, dynamic times imaginable. It's actually thrilling and exciting. But it's not, is that reflected in culture as much as it should be? We are our prisoners. All we put in the hours. What I look for when I was in my teens, I look for authenticity, I look for real ideas, I look for someone or other who was not stuck and locked into the established order that was going to do you down. And students now, who I have huge admiration for, are saying, we don't want to be done down anymore. And I was looking for someone. I found it in Bob Dylan. I found it in Highway 61 Revisited when I was that age. And I'm proud that 15 and 16-year-olds are finding opposition in us.
Wow, the Gang of Four. Still hardcore after all these years. Okay, finally, Eating Sideways, and some German. Eating Sideways is my way of referring to a foreign word or a phrase that doesn't translate easily or cleanly into English. Essentially, it works way better in the original language. So, here we go with this week's Eating Sideways.
Fremdschämen.
So, Fremdschämen is, like I say, German, and I have the German sports journalist Raphael Honigstein to thank for this, not that this word has actually anything to do with sports. Fremdschämen is a noun or a verb, he says, that, quote, describes the horrific discomfort one experiences when faced with the actions of a third party who's completely oblivious as to how awfully embarrassing they are. In other words, like working alongside a real David Brent or Michael Scott from The Office, or if you're in Germany, Bernd Stromberg. Shame on someone else's behalf. Great word. Okay, that's it for this pod. See you on Twitter or Facebook. Bye-bye for now. I'm not afraid to die.